Certainly, our perception of subjective time is a product, a fabrication of the brain. A wonderful fabrication, a wonderful illusion, if you will, in that it's created by the mind.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hello, curious and ambitious people. Well, in a couple of days, I'm packing up the car with my 3-year-old, my 6-year-old, and my wife, and we're driving 18 hours over the course of 2 days to go see my family, and then a week later, we're turning around and doing it all again. Why am I telling you this? Because I may not make it. If I don't make it, if you hear about a quadruple murder-suicide and you don't get a brain-inspired episode next week, let me just say, it's been fun. If you'd like to prevent the show ending in such an abrupt fashion, please, overnight me some MDMA. You know, ecstasy, Molly, or send me some shrooms, something, anything that lasts a long time and forces unconditional love to emanate from me. Another way that you could support the show and my burgeoning drug habit is through Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/braininspired, or you can go to my website, braininspired.co, and click the red Patreon button there, and you can support the show at either $2 or $4 per month. And that's a cheap cup of coffee or a latte per month, respectively. For those of you who have given your support recently, James, Katya, Camilo, Hester, thank you so much. Those coffees and lattes that I drink while I edit and prepare the show are the most delicious I've ever tasted. Okay, today's show, I talk with Dean Bonomano, time researcher extraordinaire. He's written 2 excellent books, his most recent of which we mostly focus on, called Your Brain is a Time Machine, The Neuroscience and Physics of Time. When I read this book, it not only taught me a great deal about what we know about how time works in the brain, and how physicists largely think about time, but it really scratched my physics itch, which sounds awesome and terrible at the same time, I'm sure. But it sent my mind reeling and soaring and into wonderful places, and that may sound effusive, but it's true, and I highly recommend the book. So during the show, we mostly talk about the neuroscience of time, but we also discuss how this interacts with AI. We talk about the nature of time in consciousness, and a lot more, of course. And this is a fascinating topic, and I hope to explore it more on future episodes. You can find the show notes at braininspired.co/podcast/18. All right, please enjoy our discussion. Welcome, Dean Bonomano, and thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure, Paul. Thank you for having me over.
Thanks for playing along.
And thank you for giving the listeners an example of our ability to understand speech at different speeds.
Yeah, well, I've got to start right off the bat. There's just so much that we could talk about. I will have said a few words about you in the introduction, but by way of a short introduction here, you run a lab at UCLA in which you study time. You do neurophysiology experiments, psychophysics experiments, and you build models of how the brain perceives time and durations and implements sequences over time. But I'd like to rewind for just a second, if you will. Is it true that in high school in the early 1980s that you programmed reaction time tests into a computer and performed these tests on your family members?
I did. I was fortunate to live in that very special window of computers where in the mid-80s, right, where computers were just becoming available, mm-hmm. but nobody knew what to do with them.
Right.
So you had to, unlike the new generation, right, where there's plenty to do with them even if you don't learn how to program. But back then, you knew they were cool, but you couldn't do anything unless you actually programmed to do something. And I did. I did definitely ask my family and friends to do reaction time tests and lexical decision tasks in terms of to measure and quantify how long the brain took to solve certain types of problems, like recognizing a word, and that would take 600 milliseconds. It was a lot of fun, yeah.
Do you still have any of your old data from those days?
You know, I probably do, but it's in those old floppy disks that I can't access.
Right. Like the really, like the three, the bigger
yeah,
floppy disks.
Yeah, those guys.
Yeah.
Those guys.
They won't, no one will know what we're talking about.
No. Okay, so. You're dating yourself too, Paul.
Well, that's okay. I'm out of the field, so who knows? You know, it doesn't matter to me anymore. So fast forward to graduate school, and you studied neural plasticity in aplasia. And of course, you published in Science magazine. Where else would you publish? And then while you're in graduate school, you attend a lecture by Michael Mock about time encoding in the cerebellum, and that big lobe in the back of our brains. And this either reignites or adds fuel to your fire and your interest in time. And to, as you know, to a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So you married your plasticity knowledge with time. And you decided to test whether short-term plasticity could be used to tell time. And indeed, you showed as much at the sub-second scale, so at timing below a second. So you built computational models that showed this, and you even showed this in vitro in neuronal culture cells in petri dishes. And I discovered you because of your work with recurrent neural networks and how their intrinsic dynamics can be harnessed to tell time, which led me to your books, which we'll talk about in the rest of your work. So if you'll play along, let's spend a second just appreciating the nature of what you are tasked with figuring out in the brain, okay? So you and I both agree that one of the most fundamental jobs of the brain is to predict the
future. Thank you.
And as humans, relative to other animals, we have perhaps a unique ability to mentally time
speech.
Oh, come, really? Travel. Mentally time travel. Okay, you're one for two. And it might be a bit macabre, actually. So, for example, Dean, do you ever think about when the day might come that you yourself will
die?
Two for three. Not bad, sir. Okay, so let's move on. And, you know, this is a speech thing. You're predicting the ends of my sentences for me, so thank you.
You're welcome.
So your brain is a time machine. The Neuroscience and Physics of Time is your most recent book. Your first book, called Brain Bugs, I hope to ask about the show. But your brain is a time machine. I love this book. It is about the neuroscience and physics of time, but it's also about the history of studying and conceiving of time, and how physics and neuroscience of time compare, whether they're compatible, the different scales of time from circadian rhythms on the larger scale down to the really tiny millisecond scales, the subjective nature of time, consciousness, free will, relativity. The word comprehensive comes to mind. So this is a great work. It's great storytelling, actually, riddled with humor as well. So thanks for writing the book.
You're welcome.
Just a few fun facts, and then I promise I'll shut up and let you speak here. I was an H.G. Wells fan, so it was interesting for me to learn that H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine, was the first to mention time travel in that the time traveler is actually interacting with the past and the future. Is that really true?
You know, I think if you look hard enough in the literature, you can probably find something that might be an exception. So people who know a lot more about the literature than I tell me there's another book by a Spanish author at the same time that also talks about what we might call true time travel. And for people to understand what we mean by true time travel, you and I are talking about these cases where somebody can go back into the past and interact with people and then come back to the, quote, present. Mm-hmm. This is very different from the fact that we can all time travel into the future, for example, if we just go into a meditative state or into a coma, for that matter, or travel at the speed of light. So it's easy to travel into the future, relatively easy. The hard part is going back and then coming back. So that's what we mean by true time travel. And I think it is true that H.G. Wells' book, if not the first, was certainly among the first in that period.
It's certainly the most well-known anyway, among the first, sure. Another fun fact. So there are no known neurological disorders or conditions that result in people losing the ability to tell time at the scale of around a second.
Well, I think it's fair to say that there's no neurological disorders in which people totally lose their ability to tell time across all scales, or completely lose their ability to tell time. There's certainly disorders that hamper or alter one's ability to tell time. Maybe they have a tendency to perceive time as going a bit quicker or a bit slower, or the old cases in people with certain types of Parkinson's disease or dopaminergic diseases have stories of people sort of moving in slow motion. These are the types of stories in the movie and book Awakenings, in which Oliver Sacks talks about people moving in slow motion. But nevertheless, those people could still sort of appreciate music or understand speech. So they could still tell time. So there's no, what we talk about is there's no centralized disease that's predominantly characterized by an inability to tell time across all its shapes and forms. But many diseases modulate timing on one time scale or in one form or another.
A little more fun one here. Do you know what a mondegreen is?
I do. Excuse me while I kiss this guy.
Yeah. So it's hearing alternate lyrics in a song, which has to do with the timing, among other things, of how fast or slow you're singing the lyrics, for instance. And in fact, I happen to know, or at least I believe, because of Jimi Hendrix's album Live at Winterland, I believe it's on that one, where he was aware that he was there, that the mondegreen was prevalent in that song. Excuse me while I kiss the sky is the lyric, of course. But people mishear it as excuse me while I kiss this guy. And there's Purple Haze, I believe. And in that rendition, he sings, excuse me while I kiss that policeman over there. So he was at least.
So although the term mondegreen, I don't think had yet been coined, but he certainly knew then that there was the ambivalent or ambiguous hearing of that. That's very interesting.
Yeah. He had a sense of humor about it, I think. Okay. Last fun fact. Animals, including us, of course, develop spatial abilities before they develop timing abilities, which is an interesting thing, and we might come back to that. Okay, so we can only scratch the surface today. We'll see what we can get to, and these concepts are going to overlap with the review paper in Neuron that we're going to talk about in a couple minutes here. But maybe we can start with just the types of time to set it up, being natural time, clock time, and subjective time. Could you just kind of walk us through those?
Absolutely. I think part of the challenge and part of the mystery in talking about time, if you walk up to somebody on the street and say, please define time, and their sort of look of panic that inevitably develops, is part of that challenge is just that time means so many things. And indeed, as you probably know by now, the word time is the most common noun in the English language. And that's because really it means many different things. And especially, and that's particularly so in English. As English speakers, when we want to know the time, we ask each other what time it is. But in other languages, you don't use the word time for that purpose. You say, what hour is it? In Portuguese, you say, que horas são. We have to, when we're having this debate about time, it's very useful to remind everybody that we really use the word time to mean different things. And I make an attempt to divide that up into three specific types of time, if you will, or flavors of time. Most of the time, there we go again.
You must do this all the time.
I know. And, yeah. and it becomes a bit annoying after a while. But more often than not, I'll say
there
that,
you go.
More often than not than saying most of the time, more often than not, when we're talking about time, we're referring to clock time, right? We talk about when we're gonna meet. We ask what time is the show on, what time is the game on, and that's clock time. And so that leads to a fairly circular definition of time is what clocks measure. And it's a bit circular there because what is a clock? It's something that measures time. But nevertheless, it's very practical and very important. And more often than not, that's what we really mean by time. Time is a measure of change as quantified by a clock. Now, in addition, we have our subjective sense of time, the time that you and I feel consciously as elapsing. The listeners might be feeling, oh, wow, this is going on forever, these two guys talking here, and they might have this dilation. So it seems we might be talking for 10, 15 minutes, but they might feel it's been already going on for 45 minutes. So that's the subjective sense of time, which is normally correlated with clock time, of course. And that sort of subjective sense of time certainly goes away when we fall asleep or when you're anesthetized. So anybody who has had that feeling of going under general anesthesia has that very surreal notion of skipping time, like what happened in between. And it's a very foreign notion that you don't have that subjective sense of time. And then finally, we have natural time, or what we might call physical time. And this is the notion of time as the problem in physics of whether time is a dimension, sort of the fabric of the universe. So in relativity, time means something more than just what a clock measures in many ways. It's something that's seen as a fundamental part of the universe, a fabric of space and time. Now, if that's really true or not is still debated. But it's another way in which we use the word time. So I think it's useful to set the tone there in thinking between clock time, subjective time, and natural or physical time.
Yeah, man, we can really go down the rabbit hole into the physics because it's you know, really interesting to me. But we're going to try to stick toward the neuroscience today. We'll see what happens. Because, you know, you have me wondering what's going to happen to all those T's in all the physics equations, you know, because, you know, it's symmetric and gosh, what are we going to do about it? What can we do about it? Okay, so those are the three types of times to start us off here. And what is the multiple clock principle?
So I think it's a useful concept when we're talking about how the brain tells time. So this relates to the brain as a device that can tell time, although not as accurately as man-made devices. So how does the brain do that? Is there a central timer that times that's used for your ability to tell time in music, to tell when you're hungry, to go to sleep, to determine your age or not? And here it's useful to come up with an analogy here. If you think about measuring quantities like weight, if you're going to measure a pound of flour, you use one scale. If you're going to measure yourself, you use another scale. If you're going to measure a car, you need another scale. These are different physical devices to measure weight or mass, dependent on the magnitude. And clocks, the clocks that we have made, man-made clocks, are amazing devices in that the same atomic clock or even the same clock on your wrist or in your smartphone is just a groundbreaking device in that it can measure milliseconds, seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years. It's really, there's not many physical devices that can measure a property across that vast range of scales. So that would what we would call a single clock. A single clock crosses scales. What I mean by the multiple clocks principle is the opposite. So unlike our man-made clocks, which function incredibly well across scales, the brain has scale-specific clocks. We tell time on the order of microseconds. So just to be clear there, you're not conscious of time on that scale, but if you have a sound to your left, you know it's to your left because your brain picked up the time difference it took to travel from your left ear to your right ear.
And the interaural time.
Interaural time delays, exactly. So that is done by one circuit in your brain. But you also have a circadian clock that tells you when to go to bed or gives you jet lag. That clock has absolutely nothing to do absolutely independent of the clock that measures interaural time delay. So what I mean by multiple clock principle is that your brain has fundamentally different mechanisms to measure microseconds, seconds, hours, days, and so forth.
So we're about to dive deeper into the neural basis of time here. And in the book and in the review that you've written, it's clear that time is nearly ubiquitous. It's a nearly ubiquitous feature of brain processing. And this is related to models of timing in the brain, which distinguish between whether there are centralized circuits dedicated to timing in the brain, or whether timing is an intrinsic property of brain circuits in general. And your research strongly suggests, and you believe, the latter, that it's an intrinsic property of brain circuits in general. So time is everywhere in the brain. Now, last week, I had Jeff Hawkins on the show, and he just came up with this framework. His idea is that your entire neocortex, all throughout your neocortex, is encoding something like grid cell location-based things. So in every cortical column, it encodes a whole object, actually, is kind of the theory. But it's all over the cortex is the idea. And that makes me think, I mean, do we know of a neural circuit that cannot tell time?
I think so. First, let me just add something here. So certainly the current hypothesis that particularly that we favor is indeed that because timing is so fundamental to everything that we do, that most circuits should be able to tell time. But that's still a theory. So you certainly find people that might disagree with that statement. But I do think it's becoming more and more accepted. And so we can record signals or neural activity patterns that can potentially encode time in many areas of the brain. Now, that doesn't mean that those parts of the brain are necessarily the clock or telling are being used by the animal to tell time. It's just like they're correlated. So you can look at a ball falling down a hill or a skier skiing downhill, and you can use that skier to tell time, right? That doesn't mean that that's his or her function. Because if you know that a downhill skier takes 2 minutes to go from top to the bottom, you can see if they're half, it's probably around a minute that's gone by. So we know that these many neural circuits have these neural signatures that can potentially encode time. But we still have to prove that that's what they're doing. Now, to answer your question, I think it's a bit early to say or to commit to the notion that there's certainly some circuits that definitely do not tell time, because all circuits are sort of dynamic. If they're always doing the same thing, if you have a neural circuit that's always doing the same thing, it's really not doing much, right? Because there's no information in it. If the light is always on, you don't need a switch to control it. You can just have it fixed. So even things that we do every continuously, like breathing, those neurons are still changing in time. They're oscillating. They're changing their frequency. So I think I'm hard-pressed to come up with a circuit that doesn't change in time. Mm-hmm. But to say if it's timing or not, I think that's a tricky question. So let's classify that as a trick question that I refuse to answer.
Yes. All right. Good enough. Okay. Well, so this book, it was just super engaging, and I have to confess, I read it over maybe 2 weeks in my little time window of from 5:30 a.m. to whenever my kids wake up.
Wow, that's impressive.
Well, you do what you have to do, you know. and we're not even touching on, you know, the physics, unless we come back to it later, or the philosophy of time, which was, again, just as fun for me. I'm going to link to the book, of course, in the show notes here. But let's move on, and these, of course, overlap, but you recently wrote a review in Neuron, the title of which is The Neural Basis of Timing, Distributed Mechanisms for Diverse Functions, and this covers the latest in the science of timing, the neuroscience of timing. You begin with showing, you know, we understand pretty well some internal clocks, so we talked about these different types of clocks, like we know a lot about the timing at the scale of the circadian rhythm, and how it works on the much larger scale. And then the much smaller scale, like the interaural time delay, we know how those types of clocks in the brain work at the few millisecond time scale. But we still don't fully understand. A lot of the open questions remaining have to do with the scale of 10 milliseconds or so to about 10 seconds. And that's what this review really focuses on. You talk about the need to develop a taxonomy of time. Can you just say what that means and why it's important?
So I think a lot of problems that scientists study generate a lot of confusion, because when we say we're going to study time or we're going to study memory, what does that mean? If you ask, so let's say the most, one of the most studied and popular fields in neuroscience is what is memory?
Right.
But if you ask those people, please define memory,
right,
you know, you're going to get different answers. So the truth is most of them are not studying the same thing. Memory, if you think of a memory in a computer, right, is memory the voltage of a transistor, whether you have a little dimple that's burned in by a laser beam on the surface of a DVD? Is that what you mean by memory? Or do you mean the sequence of zeros and ones that allow us to rebuild a picture or rebuild the voices that you're recording for this show? So memory means different things. And I think one of the really perhaps underappreciated breakthroughs of the 20th century in neuroscience was a taxonomy of memory. So you may know, and some of the listeners may know, that we make an important distinction between declarative memory or explicit memory, things that you can sort of verbalize and declare the capital of France is Paris, or implicit or non-declarative memories, such as I can juggle. And, you know, it doesn't matter how well or how eloquent I am as a speaker, I'm not going to teach you how to juggle by just describing the process.
It's impressive that you've been juggling this whole time, though.
And so those are distinct types of memory. And it's very useful to neuroscientists to make that distinction. And that really drove a lot of the progress in neuroscience, in my opinion. The field of timing, I think, has been hampered by the fact that, as we were alluding to earlier, timing really means different things. And we need to define what we mean by time. So if I talk about the subjective sense of time, your ability to tell time in music, your ability to tell time in speech as you were slowing down at the beginning of the program or speeding up, or circadian time. So what we're struggling with as a field is to sort of understand how many different types of timing we're all studying. If it's at the sensory level, at the motor level, at the cognitive level, at the unconscious level, and so forth. So that's what we mean. That's what I mean by a taxonomy of time. And mm-hmm. I don't claim to have an answer or an ideal taxonomy.
But you do, I mean, list some suggestions in the review. But you gotta start somewhere. I mean, you know, it's interesting. It's true that the study of time, scientifically, neuroscientifically, is so new still. You make the point in some of your talks and in the book, I believe, that, you know, the study of space started with Euclid, who just ignored time because that is very convenient.
I think that is a point I think is important. You know, if you think about what the first field of modern science is, I think it's fair to say it's probably geometry.
Right.
As really formalized by Euclid around 2,500 years ago. And the question is why? And I've made the argument that the reason is because science is a lot easier if you can ignore time. And that's what geometry is, right? It's the study of a universe in which nothing ever changes. And, you know, from Euclid to the great scientists like Newton and Galileo, who really started bringing in time into physics and math, it was a gap of 2,000 years. And in neuroscience, I think it's really just beginning to fully blossom mm-hmm. and embrace the problem of the brain as a time machine or as a device that's inherently temporal.
Well, and even the taxonomy of memory is really recent. So it's a lesson to be learned, I think. So it's great that you're pushing to develop this taxonomy of time because it's generated so much useful research.
Yes.
You know, so many more questions and answers. So I talked a little bit about what you have done with plasticity and figuring out how synaptic plasticity can implement timing in the range of 100 milliseconds or so. Can you sort of at a high-level description describe how that works?
So let's help listeners with what synaptic plasticity means.
Oh, you're not giving them the benefit of the doubt. Okay. No, I think that's wise.
In case my mom's listening. Neurons, of course, connected by synapses. These are these little structures in which allow one neuron to communicate to another. And what Paul and I mean by synaptic plasticity is the fact that those connection, the ability of one neuron to influence the other, is changes. And that's what we refer to plasticity. Some neurons can strongly influence another, and that's a strong connection, or a weak connection in which the one neuron does not strongly influence another. And we, neuroscientists, refer to plasticity. Now, plasticity can refer to long-term plasticity, in which these changes take place on the level of minutes and hours. And the famous example is long-term potentiation, and that's believed to be involved with memory. Now, what we're referring to here is called short-term synaptic plasticity, in which the weight of a synapse, or the strength of a connection between two neurons, changes continuously on the scale of tens to hundreds of milliseconds. Mm-hmm. This is a very ubiquitous synaptic property referred to, as I said, short-term synaptic plasticity. And what we had proposed is that one of the functions of this short-term synaptic plasticity, as opposed to long-term synaptic plasticity, is to allow neurons to remember the past, which is another way of saying to tell time, to remember the recent past of what happened 100, 200, 300 milliseconds ago. So if a synapse gets stronger over the course of 100 or 200 milliseconds, that means that neuron can, in a sense, be a bit selective to that interval. So it's simply a way to inject dynamics into a system. I mean, ultimately, we can also make the analogy with a memory. So your ability to determine if a musical note is a half note or a quarter note, really, you're asking, well, what's the duration of that note, which requires you to remember, if you will, unconsciously, how long ago it started, except mm-hmm. that memory only has to last 200, 500 milliseconds. So we had proposed and have proposed that short-term synaptic plasticity is one way the brain can do that. And our experiment, our computational work suggests that that's true, but it really does still need to be further proven at the experimental level.
Well, and this actually kind of leads into the idea of population clocks. So you could implement population clocks through synaptic plasticity, but maybe let's back up and can you talk just a second about what a population clock is?
Okay, so this is an important concept. When most of us think about clocks, because they're so ubiquitous and telling time, we imagine something that's like an oscillator. Something that's ticking, like the pendulum clock, and having some gears, and those count the oscillations of that pendulum. So the gears on our analog clocks are basically counting the oscillations, and those mm-hmm. that counting is changing with the angle of the minute hand and so forth. So people might be saying, okay, well, but how does the brain do that? And the idea here is you don't need an oscillator to necessarily tell time. Anything that's changing in a reproducible manner can potentially be used to tell time. So now imagine a sequence of falling dominoes. So if that sequence of 1,000 dominoes always falls in the same way every time you reset those, you can use that to tell time. Similarly, the example I try to use in the book to describe an example of a population clock, if you live in a big city and you look at a building at night, which lights are on? So at the beginning of the night, maybe the upper floor lights are on or the lower floor lights are on. And then for some reason, there's more residential areas on the top floor, so those lights go on after. So together, which lights are on give you an idea of the time of the evening. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with neurons. If the population of active neurons is changing in a reproducible manner, we can use that to tell time. So that's what I mean by a population clock. Using the changing patterns of neural activity to encode time. So at time 1, maybe neuron 10 and 17 are active. At time 2, maybe neuron 17 and 99 are active. And so forth. So that's what we mean by a population clock.
So you've studied this a lot using recurrent neural networks. And so we've talked about recurrent neural networks on the show before. I've never said the phrase state-dependent network, Do you want to get us up to speed with what a state-dependent network is, and then we can dive into?
Yeah, so the brain is really characterized by neural circuits that are recurrent in nature. That is, they loop back on each other. And what we mean by a state-dependent network is intuitive in the sense that it's the idea that anytime you activate a network of neurons, some neurons fire. 200 or 300 milliseconds later, that network will be in a different state, even if all the neurons have gone off, because of properties, neural and synaptic properties, such as short-term synaptic plasticity, which we just discussed. So the response to the network is always dependent on the current state of the network. The other analogy we use is a liquid. If you imagine throwing a pebble into a pond, a placid pond, that pebble will generate that nice spatial-temporal patterns of ripples. Mm-hmm. But if you throw the same pebble in, or an identical pebble, again, briefly after, it will produce a totally different pattern because the second pattern will interact with the first. So the response is state-dependent. And that state dependency allows networks to encode, once again, time. Now, in a recurrent neural network, you can use that dynamics, which can be either relatively simple or incredibly complex, to encode time or to perform a computation and so forth.
Yeah. So, I mean, there has been kind of a resurgence in these recurrent neural networks being used. And I say that, I mean, you've been using them for years now. And like I said, we've talked about them in the show, but just to make the clear distinction, what we normally think of with deep learning networks are feed-forward multi-layer networks, where one layer is usually fully connected to the next, meaning each unit in one layer connects to each unit in the next layer, and so on, with forward progression. And recurrent neural networks are wired more like the brain in that they have these recurrent connections. It's like this mass of units sort of connected to each other, so these recurrent loops form. And in the past, they've been really hard to train, because they easily become chaotic. Can you just talk about some of your work using these recurrent neural networks to tell timing and sequences, and how you tamed the chaos that can ensue, and what it might mean for how time is encoded in brain circuits?
Yeah, that's a great summary of an important distinction between types of circuits and a major distinction between deep learning, machine learning, and recurrent neural networks, which are also used in machine learning, but are characteristic of the brain. But as you eloquently said, yeah, so in deep networks, they're very sort of simplistic in a way, in that their information is flowing just from the input to the output. And the brain certainly doesn't work that way. There's all these loops that are amplifying signals. And what happens there is that this feedback is the ideal recipe for chaos. And that means, what chaos means is simply that the system's incredibly sensitive to noise. So every time you do the same thing, very small differences in state or noise will generate different outcomes. And the classic example, of course, is in the weather, in the study of meteorology, a chaotic system in which a butterfly beating its wing in the Amazon can alter the weather a week later in New York.
Sure.
So the field has struggled with this issue of chaos within these neural networks. And we and others, and you've had David Cicillo on the show, have come up with ways to try to tame or control the chaos. And what the field has struggled with is how to, and this is done, this training, when we say training, just like in deep learning, it's changing the weights of the connection. So this is the quote, again, the synaptic plasticity, but what would be considered long-term synaptic plasticity as opposed to short-term synaptic plasticity.
Okay.
So in the recurrent networks, the challenge has been figuring out how to change the recurrent connections. So if you imagine a population of 100 neurons, each A is connected to B, B is connected to A, and so forth. So there's a lot of feedback within the circuit. There's ways to tune those connections to create these stable trajectories. So what we mean by trajectories is the pattern of activity. And those patterns of activity can sort of become stable, what I'll refer to as a dynamic attractor.
There you go.
Which is sort of a amorphous term, but what it just means is you can imagine a skier again going down a hill, and if he takes the same path because he's slowly grooving in some pathway, that pathway in the snow will become the tractor. So it's not a fixed point attractor. It's not he always goes and stops at the same place, but he always converges back into that pathway in the snow.
Or he can fly off and hit a tree. But yeah, that's a good analogy.
And then it won't be a stable attractor.
Not stable, yeah. That's a good analogy, though.
And then so somehow the brain burns in those pathways. And again, the analogy here is the pathway is the pattern of neural activity. Neuron 7 and 17 and then 17 and 99 and so forth. So there's ways to tune those weights and to create these stable attractors. And what we and others have proposed is that many of the computations the brain performs are encoded not in the destination in state space, but in the voyage through state space. So the computation mm-hmm. is not the arrival at the finish line, if you will, but the trajectory taken to get to the finish line. So if you think of something like, how do you write your name or how do you play a song on the piano? The memory, the information is not static, it's dynamic. So you need these trajectories to store information that's necessary for speech or writing or walking and perhaps even thinking in most forms of cognition.
So the timing is inherent in that trajectory. Does that overlap with the spatial abilities or is that a separate circuit in the brain? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
That's a great question. And it's clear that in some times that those two things, space and distance, if you will, and time can be confounded. So this is an important question. If people record from neurons in the hippocampus of mice or rats mm-hmm. while they're on a treadmill, for example, and they find some neurons go on at the beginning of their walk on the treadmill, some in the middle, some at the end. So what are those neurons encoding? Are they encoding time or are they encoding distance walked?
Right.
And they're probably encoding both because those things are correlated. So it seems clear that space and time are, in the real world, mostly correlated, right? So this is something children learn very, very young. If I'm going a long distance, it's probably going to take a long time. And we sort of use space and time sometimes interchangeably. And this is something to digress a tad here in language, right? We say it was a long day or the movie was very short. So we use spatial metaphors to talk about time. And sometimes we do the opposite, right? We say, well, how far is your house? And I might say, well, it's 10 minutes here from here by foot, right? So it's clear that in many cases, the neurons, space and time are actually confounded. Now, so I'd be hesitant to say that my point is this is a general computational strategy and the brain is incredibly flexible. And when the computation needs just time, those neurons might be encoding time. When it needs space, it might just be encoding space or distance. But when it's most of the time, it might be very well encoding both. And it might not be a good idea to try to separate those things.
Well, this is fascinating stuff. There's a ton more in the review. If it's okay with you, let's move on. And I'd like to ask you some sort of general broad questions that will definitely overlap with all of these topics.
Of course.
So I was on a run the other day, and I was actually listening to you on a different podcast and thinking about timing and thinking about the eventual takeover of robots, you know, and I was imagining, you know, the processing speed of computers is such that these, let's say, two robots could be talking essentially over each other, anticipating what each other is going to say, and maybe that's okay. But then if my personal assistant is talking over me, that's not going to be cool with me, and they might misunderstand me, and I'll misunderstand them. And I'm wondering, you know, will it be important to explicitly encode time into like a general AI robot creature? and you know, how would we do that? Like, you know, it's hard for me to imagine if time is intrinsic to these computations, do we actually need to explicitly encode it?
Yeah. That's a very hard question to address. And you get to this issue of what's important in a computation. Is it ultimately the output that you've solved a task independent of how it was solved, or the manner in which it was solved? So in a timing task, AIs can encode time and process time in a totally different manner from humans. And that, by the way, happens. So deep networks, of course, are actually pretty good at speech recognition now. And speech recognition, of course, requires some timing. The pause between speech, between syllables, the example I often give, although AIs probably would be confused by it, is something like, they gave her cat food, or they gave her cat food.
Right.
So speech has many, many examples in which you need to tell time. So you say, I scream or ice cream. Now, how do computers, how do deep networks tell that difference? So they tell time, they're aware, quote, aware, if you will, of the difference between, or the temporal delay between the different phonemes or the different syllables. But time is represented in a very different way. It's represented in space. How a deep neural network tells time is by converting time into space. So they have a buffer for time t, for time t minus 1, for time t minus 2, time 3. So the network is basically processing the present and the past as if it's one input in the present. So there's a buffer of what just happened that's being continuously fed into the network. The brain doesn't work like that. So any device that interacts with any other system, of course, is capable of telling time or making decisions that are well-timed or generating outputs that are well-timed. Now, I think it is important to note that the way a computer then, or most deep networks, solve speech is, or represent time to solve speech, is very different from how humans do it. Now, there's other changes in machine learning that are changing that with recurrent neural networks and things called long short-term memory networks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's one level. So AIs already do that at some level, but it's very different from the humans. Now, at this longer scale of being aware or having some sort of notion of time, of the past, present, and future, this much higher level imagining, planning something. So when you plan something, you plan your trip or your jog, you say, well, I want to bring my smartphone so I can listen to this podcast. So that's planning. You're imagining the future. Now, the degree to which how AIs will achieve that or solve that problem, there's many ways to solve it. Will they do it like humans? I don't know. They probably won't. If you look at something like AlphaZero and the recent breakthroughs in chess, the AlphaZero chess, what I found just astounding is how future-oriented many of the moves looked. Right? So some of those moves were just, as Demi Hassabis said, were just alien moves. They were just like no human would have ever made that move, but they were great moves. So it's hard to look at that and say that in some sense it wasn't planning ahead or, quote,
right.
And I'm going to use this in quote here, thinking of the future. But obviously it's just the state of the system that's the best move. So what I'm saying doesn't have to be true in any real sense, but it certainly gives the appearance of thinking about the future. So when AIs become progressively more capable of flexible tasks and decision making, little by little, you know, I think the time will be represented in different ways. But I suspect there's still a lot to learn from how the brain tells time. And I would argue that one of the things that most machine learning approaches have not benefited from is learning lessons from neuroscience in terms of representing time in these neural trajectories, in these populations. And one thing I think that one of the benefits of that is referred to what I would refer to as temporal scaling. fact that, as you eloquently pointed out at the beginning of the show, is if you slow down speech or speed speech up, everybody can still understand it. So that ability to slow something down or speed something up is very tricky. But I think that gives us some of the flexibility, some of our flexibility to appreciate music at different tempos, to recognize music at different tempos, to distinguish people by their gait, presumably has a lot to do with the timing, the speed with which the arms and feet move, and so forth. So I think some of that will converge between AIs and neuroscience, and others will be independent, because ultimately there'll be many ways to solve similar problems. Hmm. But I don't know. We'll have to ask the computers once they take over.
Yeah, right. Well, okay. So my conscious experience is mostly of a world that's smoothly, continuously flowing by. So the stream of consciousness, to quote William James, can flow faster or slower, but it seems smooth. But we know consciousness is discontinuous, and bits and pieces build over time and appear then as a whole in your subjective experience. And the concept of now, quote unquote, can be any duration, you know, up to about 100 milliseconds or so. Time's not real, is it? Is time just a construct of our brains that gets, you know, presented to our awareness as we subjectively experience it? You know, the subjective time of the three types of time that we talked about?
I think so. Certainly our perception of subjective time is a product, a fabrication of the brain. A wonderful fabrication, a wonderful illusion, if you will, in that it's created by the mind. And this is a deep debate in physics. Do we perceive time flowing, the past just slowly evaporating into nothingness as it opens the doors to the future? Do we perceive that because it's real, meaning that that's happening in physics in the universe, or because that's simply an illusion in the deepest sense of the word created by the brain? Now, what we do know is that the perception of the now is indeed a construct that sort of emerges in a very nonlinear fashion. So, of course, we perceive things as flowing continuously and linearly and happening in a clear order, A, B, C, D. But we know that that's not really the case. And I think a good way to sort of grasp that is if I say a sentence like, the mouse was broken, or the mouse was dead, you don't really know what the mouse means until you hear the last word. Right. So it's pretty much impossible to be interpreting that sentence continuously, because the meaning of the word mouse can only be determined by the last word. So clearly, your brain is doing some backward editing in time. So when you feel that you just understood that word as one continuous flow, clearly that's probably not the case. And there's many examples of that. So this sense of the flow of time is your brain is continuously processing information unconsciously, and at some key points, it delivers some narrative of the world, some convenient narrative that's very comforting, into your conscious experience. And that's what we normally are aware of, obviously, because that's consciousness. But clearly the brain is continuously processing things in the background in a linear fashion, but waits to key points to deliver chunks of the story of the world around us into consciousness. So in that sense, it is an illusion and a very deep one. So I think one of the deeper aspects to your question there is the interaction between neuroscience, time in neuroscience and physics. If what we perceive is a reflection, as I said before, of actual change of the world around us or the universe as time flowing, or that's something that simply is a fabrication of the human mind. So many physicists and philosophers believe that the past, present, and future are equally real, and that there's no sense of true flow of time, Thus, our sense of the flow of time would be an illusion. On the other hand, others might argue that, no, time really is flowing, and then the brain is simply giving us a subjective experience of something that really is taking place in the external world.
This is all confounding. So actually, this is a, speaking of illusions, this is a pretty good time to ask you about your first book. So the first book that you wrote is called Brain Bugs. I don't have the subtitle in front of me, but tell us just a bit about what is a brain bug?
So here we're borrowing from the computer science, right? I mean, computational devices, whether that computational device is a standard von Neumann architecture digital computer, or that computational device is a biological neural computer, are well suited for certain computations and poorly suited for others. As a neuroscientist, I certainly went into neuroscience because I was fascinated by how sophisticated the brain is as a computational device. How is it that a neural biological computer gives me the ability to think, create, play chess, understand language, to feel love and pleasure? But as I grew older and grumpier, I really began, brains really suck at many levels, right? They don't do a lot of stuff good. And we all have our pet peeves of what we would want our brain to do better. But the trivial example is math, right? So here you have what's the most complicated computational device in the known universe. And yet we really suck at dividing 720 by 96. Right.
Hang on. No, I'm just kidding.
So good luck with that. Bring up your calculator. So why is that? Why is such a trivial numerical calculation so hard for the brain to do? And it's because the brain, in part, didn't evolve to do that. But it's deeper than that. It's because the neural hardware in our brain is ill-suited for digital calculations. So that's an example of what I would refer to as a limitation of the brain, which sort of figuratively I refer to brain bugs as those computations that the brain as a computational device is poorly suited to do, or the types of mistakes it often makes. And there's many of those, right? We can't memorize long lists of numbers or random words or sequences, so we make a lot of errors, and a lot of those errors are priming errors. And if I say something like sweet and tooth and chocolate and pie and cake, and then I ask you to, if the word sugar was on that list, many people will think that the word sugar was on that list because of the way the brain works, because of its architecture. The computer would never make that mistake because these are fundamental computational differences between how biological computer works and most digital computers work. So,
and we wouldn't really want a general AI to make that mistake either, right?
It's not clear. It's not clear. If it's the price to pay for flexibility, then maybe you would. Yeah. But maybe a general AI can have the best of both worlds.
And, maybe so.
And still have the flexibility and get the gist of a situation, but not make those limited mistakes. And the point I make in the book Brain Bugs is ultimately how our brains work, the types of computations that it's inherently good at and inherently bad at, have a profound effect on the society in which we live. If we have societal problems, anything from democracy, from and economics to drug use or cigarette-related deaths, those societal problems are a direct consequence of neuroscience, of how our brains work. And that really, as a society, we need to pay more attention to the neuroscience, because ultimately society is governed by how we make decisions, and how we make decisions is a fundamental is fundamentally constrained by our neural hardware. Yet I think most people don't think about it quite that mechanistically, and I realize most neuroscientists don't necessarily share that view, but I think it is undeniable that until we have a better understanding of why we think one way or the types of mistakes the brain makes, the best way to correct for those mistakes, the way we're manipulated by advertising or politics, the best remedy for that is to be aware of how our own brains work.
Do you think that in any way that's a price that we pay for creativity and generative abilities?
I think there certainly can be a relationship between making non-optimal decisions.
Beautiful mistakes.
And most of it, like evolution, right? You say, well, most of the mistakes are the DNA mutations. The vast, vast majority of them are for the worst. But there's those beautiful ones that drive evolution forward. And you might argue that there's something along those same lines with neural function in that we make a lot of mistakes, but those mistakes sometimes pan out, and are those sort of spurious responses are mostly mistake, but sometimes can lead to great insights and breakthroughs. So I think that's certainly a possibility. The question is, again, is can we have the both best of both worlds? And I think with a certain degree of self-awareness, we can and recognize, okay, well, that was a output, or that was a response that was probably generated by noise, and that's not worthwhile, but I recognize these other ones as potentially powerful insights.
Okay, we're hard-pressed for time here, so I have two more questions, and I think that they'll be quick. Considering your knowledge of brain bugs and how we make mistakes, as you've grown grumpier and grumpier, how has your thinking about time changed? I don't know if you can sort of sum this up quickly, because it's maybe a difficult question.
I think it's in part just being overwhelmed by the magnitude of the problem.
It's huge. That's one thing that comes across in your book and in your work is just how big it is.
And I think one thing I have changed a bit as I've become grumpier, but hopefully a bit more mature, is just to really recognize how fundamental time is to the brain. And that was the title of the book, Your Brain is a Time Machine. And I mean that at multiple levels. So mm-hmm. the brain is a time machine because it's a machine that tells time. The brain is a time machine because it allows us to remember the past to predict the future. The brain is a time machine because it creates a subjective sense of the flow of time. And finally, the brain is a time machine because it literally allows us to engage in mental time travel, to predict and to practice what I will want to do tomorrow. So in that sense, the brain is more literally a time machine. So I think certainly my appreciation for how absolutely fundamental time is to the field of neuroscience has certainly changed over damn time again.
Yeah, that's the way it works. Last question, Dean. You've written two books now, and that takes a hell of a lot of time, I know. Do you recommend authorship?
Yeah, I certainly recommend authorship in the sense that what it forces me to do is to do a lot of reading and thinking hard about a topic and trying to practice how to best express that. So authorship, if nothing else, is a crash course in something you want to learn. Now, obviously, academics, you know, it's not something I think anybody should have as a goal, because it's going to be change the world or be read by everybody, because most academic books probably don't. But I think it's something that should come out of a passion to do so, a passion to learn. I think it's odd. Sometimes I think people look at writing a book as a way to transmit knowledge. But in a way, writing a book is the best way to acquire knowledge. And I think it was Isaac Asimov, who obviously was prolific and wrote about everything, who really enunciated that very clearly. That any, he said anytime he wanted to write a book, learn a new topic, he would write a book on it, which clearly he did. And maybe he overkilled a bit. But
you're on your way. Maybe you're on your way. Who knows? But you have another one in the pipeline?
Nothing loaded up yet, no.
Well, you are at Dean Buono, on Twitter. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Great. And I'll link to your lab website, of course. So, Dean, in honor of spatializing time here, this has been too short for me. maybe I'm sure it's been too long for you, but we can't push back the end of this episode anymore. So this has been fun. And thank you for your
time.
Oh, I was going to say knowledge, but but I guess we've said time enough. Thanks a lot, Dean. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
As always, there is so much more to talk about that we couldn't get to, but I hope that this episode inspired a thought or two or three or more in you. If it did, don't let it go. Write it down. Go figure out how to act on it. Do it. If you listened last week, you heard me say that I would have Julie Grolier on the show to talk about her spintronics neural networks. So there was a rescheduling because I'm a derelict and a one-man show, and I messed up. But she will be here next week, and it will be a lot of fun. See you next time.